Well, good morning again. I was having a conversation recently with a couple ministers, not Unitarian Universalist ministers, and I heard the comment, "Oh, you're the group that has no beliefs." And you know, first of all, it's such an odd statement because you really can't function without beliefs. I mean, beliefs kind of structure how we feel about ourselves and others and our government and different things. And as the conversation went on, I said it's not that we don't have beliefs. We are not bound by beliefs. And he said, "Well, what do you mean by that?" And I said, "Well, when I first went to church, when I was 16, I'd never been to church. And my unconscious assumption was that all churches were the same and all churches said the same thing. And it was basically, God loves you. And that's basically was my whole understanding of church since I'd never been. I assumed that. And then when I entered this church, they had the pre-tribulational, and I've shared that before, rapture understanding of God. And so I just adopted that belief because I assumed all churches had that belief as well. And then shared with him that after a number of years, I went into this Rockmont Christian College, and we took a course on eschatology, the study of the end times, and I asked the minister where the Bible verses were to prove this belief that I had believed for about a decade. And he said, "Well, Gregory, we believe that by inference. And being Baptist, people of the book," I said, "no, it's got to be in the book since we believe it." And so I said, "No, once I understood," and then I learned, and that wasn't even a belief until 1826, and John Darby popularized it, and you know, and then actually getting and studying, I said, "Well, no, Unitarian Universalists, we have beliefs, but if we discover that the origins of those beliefs are really different than we had thought before, we have the freedom to let those beliefs go and not be thrown out of our communities. That's the difference. We're not bound by our beliefs. But at the same time, I know that beliefs, if you study psychology, beliefs are among the category of things that bind and create a defense against anxiety. If you look up anxiety binders that protect us from feeling the anxiety within us rather than move to soothe the anxiety and move out a healthy way but to bind the anxiety because we're fearful to experience it, you'll see alcoholism, you'll see drug addiction, you'll see relationship addiction, you'll see all kinds of things. But among those things, you'll see belief systems also bind anxiety. So the more we hold on to a belief, even in the evidence that belief is really not what we believe, it lets us know that I'm defending myself against some anxiety. I'll even hold on to that belief to defend myself against that anxiety, to fool myself into believing what is unjust is just, so that I don't have to deal with my anxiety. So today I wanted to talk about justice being the heart and soul of what it means to be Unitarian Universalism. But before I do that, I need to declare something that I learned this week, and that is that the culture war is over. James Dobson said so. So therefore, I can assume it is. In case you didn't know that the culture war was over, now you do, and he said we lost the culture war. James Dobson lost, but I didn't feel a great sense of relief if I was the winner. I don't know. I just kind of feel exhausted and afraid that the Supreme Court would begin to legislate religious law. That was my fear, stuff, things like that. And so, but then I saw these war rallying tea parties on television. And said, "I don't think the war is over. I don't think it's over. I don't think it's over that there are people in our culture who would legislate belief systems and impose it upon others. I don't think that's over." And I think that when we think about justice and who we are as Unitarian Universalists, being the heart and soul, that we need to think about justice is two processes. What happens within us and what happens in the halls of our governing processes. It's both, and we need to consider both. If I have a belief system that binds anxiety, then in a way that's unjust to me as a human being, because I'm not going to be able to experience my full self as who I am as a human being. So I need to consider both. But in our tradition, the Unitarian Universalists, and we claim religious traditions from history, whether it's Native American traditions, whether it's Christian traditions, whether it's a Hebrew tradition, whether it's a prophetic tradition, whether it's the Buddhist tradition, we claim traditions that bring life to what it means to be human. And then I began to think, well, what does that mean to have traditions? What does that mean to have traditions? We live in a society where historical consciousness is cut off. I don't know if you've heard the statement, well, if you listen to me for a while, I know you've heard it, but I'll say it again, that in our time, entertainment is becoming history. Not history, entertainment is becoming history. And I shared before, I can tell you in 1969, the Baltimore Colts lost, the Baltimore Bullets lost, and the Baltimore Orioles lost. I can tell you those things. That's entertainment. I can tell you that Denver just traded Jay Cutler, and I went, "What? How could you do that?" Right? That's occupying my mind, and you know, that's entertainment. That's not history. That's entertainment. And then I begin to structure my life inside by entertainment, not by history itself. And so, when we talk about tradition, though, we're talking about history. How do I allow tradition to have life so that when I read it and meditate and pray about tradition, that somehow it enters into me and it changes me and transforms me? In the Unitarian Universalist traditions and the traditions that we claim, we have two responses to injustice. Two. And the one I've shared, I'm going to share four different responses. The first response I have shared before was in the life of Siddhartha, was in the life of Buddha. Buddha was the son of a king, being groomed to be king, and it was a good kingdom that he had. The land was fertile, and that always helps. When the land's fertile, you can grow food to feed your people. But he realized that in his kingdom, that he was not going to be able to solve the problems of poverty, the problems of injustice. So he said, even as king, I will not be able to solve these problems. So then that's when he made the decision to give up his kingdom, to give up his future, plush future, to give that up, and to move into the spiritual practice and saying the only way to find true peace is an inner peace, is a peaceful peace. And he was going to go out, leave his community, which he did to become the future Buddha, to find that inner peace. And he said, then we can come back and we can create a society that's more peaceful. And that was his response. He left the kingdom. He left society. He went up in the Appalachian Mountains, found a place to live, and stayed there, and didn't come back. But then people went up and joined him, and they formed spiritual communities. At the same time, around 2,600 years ago, at the same time, about 2,000 miles away to his east, the Hebrew prophets were speaking. And they had a different response to seeing the same type of activity in the kingdom that was unjust. They saw the same political mayhem, the same militaristic processes, because Solomon was really an arms trader in many ways. They saw all it. They said the same thing, but they did something different. Now here's Buddha, who could be the king, so it's his kingdom. Here's the prophets, the Hebrew prophets. They were also in their own kingdom. It was their king that they were addressing. And here's what they decided to do. They decided to speak to the king. They decided to speak to those in the ruling positions. And they said these things. You oppress the poor and crush the needy. You overtax the people. You trample the needy. And you get rid of the destitute from the land. And here's a complaint from Isaiah. Those who accumulate houses are as good as dead. Those who accumulate landed property until there is no land left, and you are the only land owners remaining in the land, you are also good as dead. And I got to thinking, if I had $1 million and I waited until the housing market bottomed out, just as it was ready to come back, I could buy a bunch of houses for around $60,000. And I know that in a year from now, they'd go for about $150,000. And I could really clean up. And I thought, Isaiah taught me about that. This is what happens. This is what Isaiah is talking about. The same thing that's going on today. It really hasn't changed. It's the same. Those who devise sinful plans in the evening because they have the power to do so when they sit with the energy leaders right after they are elected to the presidency and office of vice presidency and refuse to tell the people. Oh, no, that's not what the Bible says. Sorry. They confiscate field after field. They seize house after house. Faithful men disappear. There are no godly men left. Others wait in ambush so they can shed their blood. Do not believe the lying words and have confidence in what the rulers say. The ruler should stop oppressing foreigners who live in your land, the children who have lost their fathers, the women who have lost their husbands. Stop killing innocent people. We must pay money to drink our own water. Did you know in Bolivia that people were going to be charged for rainwater because they privatized it? Bechtel was the corporation. They drove them out of the country, but since they were involved in NAFTA, they could sue the country for the profits. They lost. We must pay money to drink our own water. So that's still there. And this one always, for people who talk about immigration, see, here's how religious tradition is. If religious tradition is going to live and we're going to claim it, then actually some of my personal beliefs or some of my own desires, I got to give up. No matter what I think about immigration, no matter what it is, if I claim that these prophets are in a tradition that I'm going to organize my life around their value system, when I read this, I have to take it into account when I think about immigration. Otherwise, it's not my tradition. And here's what Malachi says. I will come to you in judgment to those who break promises, those who exploit workers, widows and orphans, and those who refuse to help the immigrant. No matter what I think, if this is my tradition, that needs to come into my decision-making process, and it needs, in a way, to have its way with me. I need to be open to that change if I'm a hard line against immigration, but I don't know how. I'm a son of an immigrant, and I'm glad my father was welcomed after a while. So I ought to have some empathy for that process. So here we have Siddhartha Buddha's response to injustice is, I'm not going to be able to change anything in this system, so I'm going to have to leave the system and facilitate a process of inner transformation. And then when we have the inner transformation, then maybe we can come back and change the system. Here's the Hebrew prophet saying, wait a minute, this has to be different. So they're challenging their king because they had the power to do so. I wish I had some of the story to say that if the words of the prophets made any difference. I don't know that part of the story. Sometimes I think we scream about values and it makes no difference, but then on the other hand it does. So here's another response to a prophet who was speaking to an oppressed population where there was injustice. And the first century prophet, Jesus also had something to say. And there's something curious about what he had to say, because he is in the line of the prophets who spoke directly to the kings and said, this is wrong. This is the problem. This needs to be different. Jesus is in that line, except in his time as a prophet, he was under the control of another empire. So he wasn't addressing his own people. He wasn't addressing the king. So he kept his words away from the political process, much like Buddha. And here's what he has to say about the kingdom from his viewpoint. The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sows good seeds in a field. The kingdom is in heaven is like one who plants a mustard seed and it grows into the tree. The kingdom of heaven is like baking bread. The kingdom of heaven is not eating or drinking, but it is peace and joy. So here we have a person who responds to an oppressive environment and said, the kingdom is within, and it's a transformational process that takes time. And you need to take the time for the transformational process in order to nurture whatever this kingdom is that he is talking about. So there's another response we have to a ruling class of people and talking about injustice and how to deal with injustice. One is, I'm going to separate myself from the injustice, from the poverty, from the suffering, and create another community where we can treat one another well. And if you remember the story of Buddha, that he met the untouchable in the forest, and 10 years later, the untouchable, which couldn't even touch other people in the community, the ones who had to do the dirtiest jobs, became one of the chief monks, I guess, chief monk, something like that, in the community. Okay. So he went to here. Then you had the Hebrew prophets who would come in and directly challenge their kings. And then you had, by the time the Roman Empire had conquered that part of the world, you have this prophet Jesus saying, wait a minute, the kingdom of God is within you and you need to nurture that, and it takes time. There'll be a seed planted, there'll be years that go by. You're in this process of transformation for years, and you really need to pay attention to your inner world, because that's where the transformation occurs. Not even addressing the political injustice. Now, let's jump up 1,500 years and look at another response to injustice. In a book by Alvaro Llosa, he wrote a book called Latin America and the Oppression of Latin America for the Past 500 Years. And if you look at your white sheet of paper in your bulletin, you can see that model that I pulled out of his book and what that's like. And he said that in analyzing Latin America for 500 years, this is what he discovered. That issues of corporatism, state mercantilism, political law, privilege, and wealth transfer, taxing the poor people, giving it to the wealthy, privilege, those who are governed are in league with businesses and they get privileges and special treatment. Political law, the legislative structure that keeps that system going through time. State mercantilism was a class-based society, which in Latin America is very interesting because their laws were not about individuals. Their laws were to groups of people, not individuals. So you belong to a group and you had special laws to you. And then corporatism. And he said, it for 500 years, it did not matter what type of government that you tried to introduce, whether it was democracy, socialism, totalitarianism, fascism, it didn't matter. In the container of these five characteristics that were law, eventually, no matter what newness you tried to do to deal with the injustice, it would transform itself back into what it originally was. You could not change it because of this structure was that way. And when you look at laws for groups of people, it's interesting. He had the nobleman list first, the priest and the lawyer. Does he have to compare ministers to lawyers? Or lawyers to ministers? I'm not sure how that works. The tradesperson, the peasant, and the slave. So there's different laws for different groups, and that's what structures that society. The same thing was true, however, where Buddha was, where Siddhartha came up. You have laws for priest and teacher. These ministers, man, they get top on the list, don't they? You got to love that, or not. Then political, military, merchants, farmers, manual laborers, and untouchables. Very similar system in Latin America from 500 years ago, 500 years. It's curious, isn't it? Completely on the other side of the world. Very similar system. Then in the United States of America, in 1776, we had this thing called the Bill of Rights, where the rule of law was going to deal with individual people. However, there were certain groups that were not included at that particular point. Women, African American, indentured servants, non-property owners. They were also groups that laws dealt with, as well as individuals. But we do see a breakthrough. And just in brainstorming today, and I think, well, in one way, you got to love the political system because it just gives you example after example after example of what you want to say. And I'm thinking, here, are there laws for groups of people today? Right? And it was Helen's second-born, Ian, talking about our president's decision not to prosecute people when they had evidence that a crime was committed, accessory after the fact, but nonetheless, are there groups of people that the general rule of law does not apply to? Yes, we still have that. If we look at the prison population, we clearly have laws against groups of people, African American young men, as compared to the general population, the political elite. A Bush aide stole $600,000 that was supposed to go to a Latin American country. He gets 30 months in jail. $600,000. Person's caught with a bag of marijuana, say for the third time, for an ounce of marijuana. Depending what state you're in, that could be a life sentence. Right? We can't even get the Equal Rights Amendment passed. Did you ever read the Equal Rights Amendment? Basically says equal rights for women. Basically, that's all. We can't get that passed. Are there laws that are not on the books? Well, there are actually some laws on the books that atheists can't run for office. We still have laws for groups of people, and we still have laws that we say we are protected by, but they're still there. We still deal with it today. So again, as Unitarian Universalists, we ask ourselves, in our tradition, we are guided and directed by several choices when we look at justice and the issues of injustice. So if you turn that piece of paper over, I thought I would draw another model that was very similar. Map, except it's a little different in that we have the United States legislative and governing processes in our economic systems. And what I'm suggesting today as Unitarian Universalists, we need to be careful with how we spend our time, our resources, and our thoughts. Because one thing we don't want to do is we don't want to invest ourselves into a particular activity and at the end have it be meaningless or have there be no potential for change. So do we make the decision like Buddha made and say we really cannot affect change? And if we really cannot affect change, then in our tradition we are taught build a community where people can find sanctuary and people can find peace and people can be nurtured and come in and people can be treated well and we can treat the wounds from an oppressive society. Or we also have in our tradition the Hebrew prophets who got into the face of the ruling class, got in the face of the governing process and said this is not right and it needs to change. So that's a decision we as Unitarian Universalists need to confront. So on this model, I just took some guesses at legislative processes that might be surrounding our legislative government and put the emerging nobility, moneyed representatives, the millionaires in office, targeted educational systems. We don't have to go too far to the center of the state and compare the books that those children get to the books that the children get on the east coast of the state. We don't have to go too far to see what targeted educational systems mean. What it means is some folks are going to get a good education, and some folks are not, just by where they live and just because of who they are. Financial regulation, trade agreements and legislation, and now all of a sudden, I think regulation is becoming a positive word. And being a people who, on our seventh principle, talk about being part of the inherent web of existence. We know that the inherent web of existence is a regulated system. I know my blood pressure is a regulated system because if it gets out of whack, I want something to help me regulate that process. We know that. We know that regulated and a balanced system is what produced us as human beings. To think that we could create a system that doesn't have any regulations and it's going to be good for us doesn't make any sense when we back out and look at it. One thing that the Hebrew prophets did when they called their ruling people to justice, one thing that does is it says there are boundaries. There are limits. There's not perpetual growth forever. That does not exist. Justice acknowledges finitude. Justice acknowledges that there are boundaries. Justice acknowledges we have to share the resources that are around us. And when we live in a culture that is driven by an economic system of perpetual growth, a religious system of that one day there will be, we will live on streets of gold, however you want to put that together, limitlessness, that we can live in the infinite and ignore the finitude and ignore the finite, is a suicidal walk. It will lead to, look what it's doing. It is doing exactly that. So, when the Hebrew prophets call for justice, they become a group that's scapegoated. When Unitarian Universalists call for justice, we become a group that's called a cult. We don't even have a God. How can you be called a church? Let's get rid of their nonprofit status. You're a group of people without any beliefs. Oh, you're one of those. Went to an interfaith meeting. You're one of those. No discussion. I don't know what one of those is, but whatever that is, I'm one, at least in that person's imaginative process. We have a rare chance in the history of what it means to be human beings living in this country. Like the Hebrew prophets, I'm suggesting that today we live in a time and a place where when we speak, we can make a difference. But we have to target where we're going to spend our energy. And where we need to spend our energy is the election process and legislation. If our energy is not focused on those issues, then we can't change the container in which we live in, the economic system and the legislative system and the societal and cultural structure. If we just start picking things, our favorite project, to try to change, and we don't change the container of that system, no matter what we do, it will always go back the same. I was listening to Elizabeth Warren. She is the, professor, economic professor at Harvard, who's in charge of the TARP oversight on Jon Stewart, not to be plugging one of my favorite news shows, but Jon Stewart. And what she said was that from 1890 up until 1945, every 10 to 12 years, you can see peak and bust economically and people losing their... But from 1945 until around 1970, you didn't see that. But there were tight regulations on financial institutions, on transportation, on communication. There were serious regulations. Then the regulations became, the tapestry was started to unthread, and we go back to the 10 to 12, every 10 to 12 year, we see that. Right now, we're in that container that produces that cycle of every 10 to 12 years, and we're looking at the injustice of that, and we're looking at the movement of a greater sense of poverty. We're looking at the movement. In 1984, I believe we had 500,000 people in prisons. At how this is related, I don't know. It's happening at the same time. Regulation starts unraveling. Now we got 2.4 million people in prisons, and we got to over 6 million people in the prison probation process. We have a choice. The choice is to separate ourselves from the kingdom or to engage it if we want to deal with issues of justice. We are privileged to live in a time where we can make a difference. if we're intentional about what we're going to address and how we're going to address it. And when you look at the Unitarian Universalist history, when you look at the justice issues of being victims of injustice, and also being part of the process to create a just society, it is in our blood to begin to be part of a process that creates a just society. It is just who we are as a people. We need to make the decision and then, at the risk of manipulating, act to change the system as opposed to separate ourselves from it. Because we are privileged today to live in a society where we can make a difference.